He'll hand it over to Karen, who will give us an overview. And then the format for this session is really a roundtable with our panelists to talk about implementation details. So let me hand it over to Kirk.
Thank you, Margie. Thanks for coming. This is intended to be a working session. So what we wanted to do was have a big roundtable discussion about Trademark Clearinghouse and its implementation, but the rooms don't always lend themselves well to the topic or the format we want to pursue, so bear with us. The idea is this, that ICANN is in the middle of its new GTLD program implementation that it's been working on for some time. One important aspect of that is to secure the services of a trademark clearinghouse provider. And the Trademark Clearinghouse has a few duties. It must take in data from trademark holders and maintain the database of the trademarks that are and the other intellectual property that's registered in the clearinghouse. And obviously that has to be done with a great deal of accuracy and care, so maintenance of that database. And then it has to help administer at least two processes, the IP claims process and the Sunrise processes for when new registries actually launch, so to administer those processes. And so we are in the process of securing the services of a clearinghouse provider. Rules for how the clearinghouse operates are in the applicant guidebook, the intended purpose of the clearinghouse, as I described, but with more specificity, and some rules for how it's going to operate. But really, there's a lot of detail to be worked out in order to ensure two things. One is that the clearinghouse operates efficiently and well, that in charging for its services, it's not charging too much. And in its operation, it's not creating a burden for registries, registrars, and others that would use the clearinghouse, but rather sort of fits in with its operation. So in our procurement of clearinghouse services and our implementation of the clearinghouse, we want to consult with the experts in creating that very specific set of rules for how the clearinghouse is going to operate. Some of that work's already taken place. Jeff Newman from Neustar led an effort of different experts in fashioning some operational rules around the IP claims process and how that might work. And this session is really to build on that. So what we have here are some of my some of the friends I've developed over the last 6 years in working on this to discuss operational aspects of the clearinghouse. And we've invited registry operators, registrars to talk about the operational aspects and how to make that economical for the registries and registrars to operate. And we've also invited members of the IP community because we don't want to lose sight of the goal. Why did we establish this clearinghouse and what are the benefits we're trying to confer and what are the protections for trademark holders? We don't want to lose that as we start to delve into the operational details. So we've asked these people up here, you know them all, but Mary Wong, J. Scott Evans, Nick Wood, John Nevitt, Russell Prangborn, Jonathan Robinson, Deborah Hughes, Joe Waldron, Jeff Newman, Matt Serlin, Bart Lieben, and Christina. Did you just Christina Rosette just came up? And so we're gonna ask Karen to kind of lead them through a series of three sets of questions, one about the database, one about IP claims, one about Sunrise, and discuss some of the operational details here or what the thoughts are. Following this, what we want to do is carry on with that work continue an iterative discussion with the community and experts so as we do a formal request for proposals and write these set of rules, we're writing them in a way that meets the goals of the program. So thanks very much for coming. I hope you find it really useful. And what we want coming out of this is, any advice you have for ICANN in implementing that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Karen. And I want to thank you guys in advance for all the thought you're going to put into this.
Okay, the agenda is up on the screen, how we think the session will run. There are essentially three major processes arising out of the Trademark Clearinghouse and what it's intended to do, and we'll spend some time with each of those. As Kurt mentioned, the staff is here in listening mode. These are considerations that we're looking for that we need to be aware of in going out to the RFP and finding a Trademark Clearinghouse provider. There's a rough timeline up here where we are now. June 2011 is developing process flows with the community. It's part of what we're doing now. The orange arrows along the bottom have to do with developing an RFP and going out and making that process to secure a provider. And then further along, there's an integration of those two processes to turn it into something operational. So the workshop goals, as has been said, is to identify the implementation details we need to be aware of, collect feedback from the affected parties here, the stakeholders, and everyone here in the audience, and then determine how we're going to proceed with those discussions as the implementation continues. So the first aspect that we're going to talk about, the Trademark Clearinghouse is meant to be a repository of data concerning trademarks and trademark rights. It's intended as a central location that will create efficiencies for trademark holders and others who are part of the process by having a central location to go to for this information. So the first aspect of this will be how does that data get entered, and if I'm a trademark holder, how do I maintain the information that I've put into the clearinghouse? And going through the thought process on this, the main questions that have come up are here on the screen here. How do we populate the clearinghouse? What kind of authentication process will the Trademark Clearinghouse perform on that data? How will they ensure that the data is accurate? How will users be able to access and update that data when they need to? Essentially, there's a pretty simple three-step process here. When you go enter data into the clearinghouse, you're going to provide information and supporting documents. So according to the documentation that's been developed to date, the eligible trademarks are those that are registered, validated by a court, or protected by a statute or treaty. So the first step is obviously to provide the data of what sort of trademark you have and how that can be proven or documented. There is also a set of terms and conditions. You're attesting that the information is accurate. You're providing some consent to the clearinghouse provider for that data to be used for certain mandatory required services that the registry operators will be providing. And there's also an option whether you'd like the data to be available just for the mandatory basic services, or whether you'd also permit the data to be used for certain ancillary services that may be offered. And then there's an expectation that there would be some fee associated with entering that data, and that's another detail to be worked out. So going through the documentation that's been developed by the community so far, the list I have up here is the data that's been listed as what would be collected at the time a trademark holder is entering their information in the clearinghouse. That will differ according to what type of trademark it is. It may be registered, in which case you're providing certain information. It may be court validated or protected by a treaty. The line up there about the class of goods or services is something that was listed in the STI's sample trademark claims notice, which is something that we'll talk about later. But the assumption is that if that is to be provided in the notice, that's something that needs to be collected up front, although that hasn't been specified in the other documents that I've seen. So that's something to discuss. And then in addition to collecting that information, as I said, there's a declaration that the information is correct, will be kept current, et cetera. There's a consent to use of that information for the purposes of the clearinghouse, and then there's the option for how you're permitting that data to be used. So the first question I'll pose here is, you know, it seems fairly straightforward. This is what we want to collect. Is there anything missing? Is there some capacity that is will be expected or needed by rights holders when they are entering this data? So I'll open that up to anybody who'd like to comment.
Karen, it's Margie. I think Amy wanted to provide some explanation on the types of intellectual property that could be included in the clearinghouse.
Yeah, so I just wanted to supplement the first slide that talked about the registered marks or marks that are protected by statute or treaty or validated by court are the ones that must be recognized in one or the other of the protection mechanisms, either claims and or Sunrise. Obviously, it now has been opened up to other marks that also constitute intellectual property, but those can be put into the database in the clearinghouse, but aren't necessarily required. And the manner in which those will be used, it will be something that will be up to the registry, who is providing its own other trademark protection mechanisms.
Christina, go ahead.
I apologize if I'm getting too far ahead of ourselves, but I would say in terms of a copy of a registration, I think it would be fantastic if it would be possible for the trademark owner to, if a physical copy is required, to have it be a simple copy. Getting certified copies, notarized copies, et cetera, can be very time-consuming, and when you're talking about what is likely to be multiples, that expense can add up very quickly. The one thing that I would actually also encourage you to consider is whether it would be feasible if the submission in lieu of a physical copy of the registration could provide a link to the record for that registration to the online publicly accessible trademark database from the country that issued it. So that you know, again, I think you'd have to, and I think there is somebody from the PTO who could probably speak to whether or not you can rely on links like that. But I think doing that, I mean, let's take advantage of the fact that so many of these trademark offices now have the records online. Certainly there are those that don't. But to the extent that there are and you can, let's at least explore that.
Okay. Jeff has a comment.
Yeah, I was just going to agree in part, I guess, with Christina. I think I'm not sure why a physical copy of a registration is actually needed if you can have some automated mechanism of checking the online patent and trademark office. I'm not sure you could do a direct link because at least with the USPTO, they don't allow deep links. They usually, at least up to a few months ago, I haven't done it in a while, but it's usually just links into the homepage, or to the search page. But I think, yeah, an automated mechanism of checking with the Patent and Trademark Office should be enough. I think the physical copy is just going to – there's some offices that aren't online, and in those cases you would get the copy. But otherwise, okay. It should be automated.
Okay. I think Nick has a comment.
Yeah, it was a simpler point, really, about the data to be collected, that I think you probably need the date of first registration and the date of expiration as well.
Jay Scott?
I think there needs to be some data point for assignment documents, because many times the original certificate of registration could be listed in the name of an entity that no longer owns that, because they don't, at least in the United States, and I believe in most jurisdictions, they don't reissue certificates. So it's only through assignment records. So you need to do some sort of documentation to show whether there's been an assignment so that the person putting it in can show that they actually have title. Another comment to Amy. Amy, I think that the guidebook's use of other marks is confusing, and that needs to be changed to other indicia, because we're already talking about marks in trademarks, and if you just make that one change, because I think the idea is there are other indicia other than trademarks that might be protected by the local registry, and we just need to make that clear, because I think there's some confusion. Well, if trademarks are here, what are other marks?
Right, and with respect to the assignment issue, sometimes the database that has the assignment documents may be different than the actual database that has the actual registration. So looks like it's something.
So I just think as the data collected, you need to put in a bullet point that says, you know, if, like you do for use, if applicable, assignment documentation showing title or, you know, something to that. Right. But that is a data point that will need to be provided.
Thank you. I think you have a comment over here. Jen.
Thank you. My name is Oliver Zumiff on behalf of Dot Hamburg. I have a question regarding the kind of trademarks. According to most of the trademark laws, at least according to the national legal frameworks in Europe, they are very different kind of trademarks. You can enter a string as a trademark, which probably is the most well-known one, but you also can enter or register a picture or a logo as a trademark. In addition to that, you can, at least according to the law in Germany, register tones that might be a symbol for some commercial spots or things like that as a trademark. Will all these different kind of trademarks will be entered in the clearinghouse, or is it just the string that is protected?
As I understand the guidebook, it's going to adhere to the other sunrises and claims that have existed in the past, and it is only for text marks and only protects the text. And I believe there is some allowance for the deletion of textual representations that are not available in the string. So if it has a apostrophe, it's a plural possessive, or if it has an ampersand or a dash, those can drop out, but it would still be protected if it's textually represented in the registration.
Thank you. I have Bart.
Yeah, maybe commenting on that. I think that I should look into a way on how to define the word wordmark, because there's no universal definition of that. For instance, if you in quite a few PTOs, if you register, for instance, a trademark in Chinese script, then they say that it's a device mark, certainly when Chinese is not the official language of that country. So there are things where it can be dubious. So first of all, you have PTOs that do not distinguish between wordmarks and not wordmarks, so device marks are figurative signs, combined marks. So this is something where I think you the guidebook or the guidelines should shed a bit light on what that could be.
Okay, thank you. And it's Christine, right?
Two points, and I guess this is a question and then perhaps a suggestion. Is it the intention that each trademark owner would only identify one point of contact? So that, not to pick on Russ, but that it would be, you know, Russell Pangborn, Microsoft Corporation, da-da-da-da-da, or can a trademark owner put in multiple contacts? Because what I think you might want to suggest to trademark owners to do is that there would be one individual identified, but that in order to facilitate effective implementation of this, that there be that they create some kind of email alias. So again, not to pick on Russ, but that it would go, instead of his email address, it would go to trademark clearinghouse questions or whatever at Microsoft.com, so that people have a way to do that. The other thing is that although I believe the IRT recommendation was that registered trademarks be limited to the principal or primary register of the country of origin, that delineation didn't make it into the guidebook. And in the U.S., marks that are registered on the supplemental register are deemed inherently descriptive, and for purposes of trademark claims, I would think that a potential domain name registrant would want to know that. So I think you are going to have to indicate that at least for U.S. registrations, whether or not if it's a registration on the supplemental register.
Good comments. I think Debbie was next, and then Joe.
Just Just a quick comment going back to documentation for proof. I think for treaties and for national legislation, I agree with the comment that was currently made about going to official databases instead of sending in paper. I think there's ways to do that, Amy and Kurt, that makes sense. There's official databases for many legislations throughout the country. For example, for the Geneva Conventions, I could point you to the exact location where you could find the exact relevant sections rather than sending in paperwork. So just kind of picking back on the documentation issue for those types of marks.
Joe? Yeah, I'd like to just expand a little bit on the comment you made about a Chinese trademark that would be registered. I think we need to address all of the standard IDN issues when that occurs in terms of what's being actually recorded in the registry and then what's being transmitted to the actual domain name register, the TLD registry, to ensure that we don't have a mismatch of the representation and the way that is converted. We use PUNY code to be able to do that. So you could have a complete mismatch. Even though they may appear the same, they're going to look as very different entries in the registry.
Okay, Matt.
Yeah. So then, Joe, would you enter in the PUNY code as part of the clearinghouse database? Do you think?
To be honest, I don't think I have a solution at this point. I think it's an area that needs to be addressed to ensure that there is consistency with the trademark, the way it's registered, and then the representation of the domain name that goes into the registry.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. So to follow up on that, in the interest of declaration, I am the architect of a clearinghouse that's currently being used in a couple of TLDs, and that could be part of the proposal for becoming the ICANN clearinghouse. The way how we do it is we have a representation of the mark, and then we have basically the representation of the domain name without the extension then. That could then be forming part of a sunrise or a claim. So we have both fields, actually. So we have the PUNY code and we have the actual representation of the mark in addition to that. Yeah.
Right. And then, but that also then implies that there's some consistency and standardization across all of the registries that you'll be dealing with, so that they've all done the same implementation of different language tables. I mean, so there is a very tight coordination that needs to be done between all of the GTLDs and the trademark clearinghouse.
Yeah, and even so, the way how we currently do it, so even if there's a different implementation, we basically lock the implementation of the IDN tables to the extension, so we can translate all of them if you want. So,
thank you.
So there's a complexity.
We have one more comment on this, and then we'll go to Karen, who's going to go to the next slide.
Yes, very quick comment, and thanks, guys, for bringing this up. I mean, the IDN part, Bob, and you've talked about some details about linking the converted PUNY code to the IDN mark, just to make sure that you add those, for example, like the details, like the language tag, and how you can do batch processing when you deal with a large amount of trademark registration in the clearinghouse, just to add that. Thank you.
And maybe very, very quickly, with respect to the name and contact information for the trademark holder of record, our experience learns that in quite a few cases, this data that is kept by the PTO is not up to date. There are various reasons for that. For instance, if a company merges or if it changes its name, it generally waits until the time where the trademark expires in order not to pay additional taxes to the PTO for just changing the name. So do take into account that about 15 to 20% in some of the PTOs, you have inaccurate contact data. So basically what we do is we get the contact data from the brand owner itself, and if we see that there's a mismatch between what we get and what what we see in the PTO, we ask the brand owner for an explanation.
Thank you, Bart. That's actually a great segue to the next slide. Oh. Nick, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just before we moved off this this topic of the data that needs to be collected, I wondered if I could ask ICANN about the ancillary services that you imagine that the provider of the clearinghouse could also offer, because that goes to the heart of the type of data that's collected. Would you allow an operator to collect other data?
So obviously we haven't imagined all the ancillary services that a clearinghouse might want to provide, but there are other services. For example, a watch service is an ancillary service that will proceed beyond the initial 60 days of the IP claims notice. So it would be something along those lines. And with whatever other ancillary services there are, I'm sure there'll be some innovation going on.
So maybe
we need to go on to the next topic.
Okay. Well,
that's all right.
I just
wanted to
mention that the data that we generally get from the brand owner, in 50% of the cases, it's wrong. So don't ask for too many data.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the next section of what we're going to talk about here actually has to do with accuracy and authentication. So the requirements have been developed to have an expectation that the clearinghouse will come up with a list of data authentication sources, websites of patent trademark offices in various countries around the world, and then any third-party providers that might have access to that data and would be authoritative. There are a few tasks here. One is to verify the accuracy and matching of the contact information that's given. As has already been mentioned, there's some issues with that. And then the authentication of the trademark data itself. So you're looking at, how do I make sure that you are who you say you are when you're providing me with this data? And second, how do I ensure that the trademark documentation that you're giving me is real? So any comments on how those steps should operate?
Christina?
I just have a threshold question, and I apologize if I missed this. Is it the anticipation that trademark owners would be submitting the information directly, or would it go indirectly through the registrars? I would actually suggest the former, but I'm just wondering what the intention is.
I don't think that's been established. I think we're open to suggestions on that.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the initial concept was that it would be submitted directly, but if people have other ideas, we're open to them.
I would say, based on past experience, directly is probably what registrars, if they have any sense, would want, because in prior rounds, there were more mistakes made by registrars who were dealing with volume issues than there were by the, and it caused a lot of service problems for them. I'm casting no aspersions, but it was a lot to take on.
Matt?
Yeah, no dispersions taken. I think it's probably something that needs more discussion, but from my perspective, the option to do it both ways, frankly. If a trademark holder wants to go direct, if they want to go through a registrar, I don't see why we wouldn't have that option.
Russ, yeah, and then Nick, or Nick and then Russ. Okay.
Right, go ahead. Jonathan.
John, sorry.
I would support what Matt said. I think, and more than that, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that the marks owners may be the best original source of the information, many of them use agents, whether they're registrars or not. And so I would say the ideal perhaps would be to have the option of both and leave that in the hands of the market to decide.
I was going to say the same thing. What goes into it is going to be twofold. It's one, either going to be cost, where people will want to do it directly to save the money, and then there's the other resource aspect. If you don't have the horsepower internally to do it, you may want outside agents to be the ones to do it for you. So you should keep the options open.
Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing about leaving the options open. I mean, we're only talking about registrars and direct, but let's face it, there could be law firms, there could be companies out there that already do trademark protection that have nothing to do with domain names. So just leave the option open for anyone to submit directly to the clearinghouse.
Okay. Anyone else? Go ahead.
I guess it's just a very small supplementary point. There is a question then of some form of, there I said, accreditation to engage with the clearinghouse. And so it's a question of that'll need to be thought about, is what, under what circumstances and what tests do you have to pass to engage with the clearinghouse?
Jeff?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I think if you have just a direct web portal, I think you're not going to need to accredit anyone to do that. I think that just adds needless steps.
Respond. Probably, accreditation is probably the wrong word, but there'll be, I mean, you need some form of registration, as we all do, for any consumer website or something, some way of identifying yourself as a submission agent, or whose behalf are you doing this?
Yeah, and I also think that it's not just a web page input, right? I mean, if you're right, it could be an EPP connection from a registrar to the clearinghouse. So I do think that there is some level of validation or authentication or something that needs to take place outside of just obviously going to the website and filling in the data.
Mm-hmm. I do agree. So I think it's absolutely necessary to have that authentication step and to have different types of interfaces. So a web-based interface which one single brand owner with one trademark can use on its own, or have, we have XML that we're using for bulk submissions.
Any other comments on this or from the floor?
Werner Staub from CORE. I have a question that is related to that and actually ends up being almost the same question. If you say, should the registrar be able to go directly or not to send the data to the clearinghouse, are we really sure there has to be one single monolithic clearinghouse, or could it be organized in a way that we have the UDRP, where you have more than one form actually available? And if you look at the underlying data, contrary to the domain name, we don't have a situation where any string would be exclusive to anyone who possibly want to have a claim or a trademark in there. There could be more than one who have it. If you look at the problem that we have very different legal frameworks, and the fact that even the data that has this collected may have to evolve naturally, and this could be a question of supply and demand, and people actually adapting in the context of their environment. You might think of having multiple component system, whether it could be European and Asian or several Asians and the North American, South American component of the thermal clearinghouse. That would be separate and exchange the data with very simple synchronization methods.
Does anyone want to comment to that? Jeff?
I just have a question. I thought it was pretty clear in the guidebook now that there's only one clearinghouse. There could be multiple validators in theory, but I thought that was pretty clear in the guidebook that was approved.
Okay. Yeah, we're getting confirmation from Kurt that that's correct. Christina?
I apologize for not raising this on the previous slide. Maybe it's this one. But you all are going to have to figure out what you're going to do in terms of evidence of use. And, you know, I don't even know where to tell you to start on that, to be perfectly candid.
Okay. Do you want to go on to the next slide or anything more?
Okay. So the proof of use was indeed on the previous slide. That is a function that the clearinghouse would be expected to provide. So certainly we're open to suggestions on how that can be effectuated also. Anything else on this slide? Okay, and then this is kind of to wrap up this session. There are a few sub-processes that would go along with maintaining data in the clearinghouse. First of all, who has access to it, and what's the process for validating that access? How do I update if I've changed my address or I've stopped using a trademark or some other type of change? How do I go in and make that change? And then what is the process for removing a trademark from the clearinghouse? There's various ways that could occur. If a registration, for example, was found to be invalid, there would be a procedure for removal. So any comments on that last aspect?
Yeah. Jonathan?
We were talking about this with some colleagues last night, and certainly one of the issues is thinking about this in terms of a multi-year process, because we've heard many, many numbers about how many applications might come in for new GTLDs, but take any number you like and envisage a certain percentage go through relatively easily and are out there and will go through a cycle of implementation. But then as one goes down into the long tail of the applications, these are likely to take longer and longer to come out. And it may well be that some go beyond, for example, an initial period envisaged for the clearinghouse. And so notwithstanding the fact that there may be other rounds of TLDs, even if one simply envisages a single round, those may take a substantial period of time. So it's a requirement, I would imagine, to not only have an update process, but a requirement for the clearinghouse to operate on an ongoing basis, at least insofar as the first round has a long tail, but as I say, also extending potentially into other rounds.
Jay Scott.
I think it's very clear that there's going to have to be something similar to a registry lock on all the information once it's entered and been put there, and then there would have to be some sort of validation that's done now. I mean, they do that with my domains. You know, the most valuable domains, there's a process that I go through with my registrar, and they're going to have something very similar to that to unlock and let this information be updated, because you run the risk of some sort of fraud occurring in a situation where it's been just entered in through a portal. So you're going to have something where there's some sort of lock in the information that has to go through a process to get it opened back up. Even if you know, a simple passcode that you put into the system, I think, is not necessarily the best firewall for this type of thing, but there needs to be some thought given to that.
So making it more difficult to update the information so that you avoid fraud or some inadvertent change.
I mean, just as innovative as people are to do the nice things, they're going to be just as innovative doing the bad things. And so we need to, on the front end, know for sure that given the fraud we've seen in startup mechanisms in the past, .eu being a prime example, when it was much more complicated to be fraudulent than it could be in this situation, we need to build in protections now. Mm-hmm. So I would say some sort of firewall or double firewall protection that even if you give a trademark owner, there's something more complicated than entering a simple password to get into that information.
Okay. John, you had a comment?
Yeah, real briefly, just to follow up on Jonathan's point, the clearinghouse is going to be used for URS for, you know, in the future as well. So it's not only using it for new TLDs in their initial periods, but the URS will go on, obviously, forever.
Bart?
Yeah, I would suggest to keep this as lightweight as possible for brand owners. Due to all the complexity, so if I see on the slide here penalties for failing to keep information current, as I mentioned, quite a lot of information that is officially available is not current at this point. So you would actually be imposing a requirement upon a brand owner that currently does not exist even in trademark law. So do keep it as lightweight as possible. If a brand owner says, okay, I have taken over this company or we've merged with organization XYZ, that there is some kind of an update process, that there is indeed a lock, as Jay Scott suggested, because in EU it was impossible to change the contact data just in order to avoid this type of gaming that potentially could have taken place, which hasn't at that point. And certainly if registration is found to be invalid or if there's fraud on behalf of the self-proclaimed brand owner, at that point in time, of course, you need to have a removal process in place. Yeah. But that is, of course, well, what we in the clearinghouse have is a process that basically encompasses that.
Okay, thank you. Back to Karen.
Okay, thank you. I think there's been a lot of very helpful insights already just in this section. I'm going to move on to the next section of the agenda, which covers the trademark claims process. This is a process associated with the clearinghouse where clearinghouse data is used. Within the first 60 days of general registration, a new TLD or registry operator would be required to provide this trademark claim service, which involves presentation of a claim notice to a potential registrant if they are attempting to register a name that matches an entry in the clearinghouse. And it also involves facilitation of notice to a trademark holder that has entered data in the clearinghouse when a name is registered that matches their trademark. You know, this process involves several parties. It involves the person trying to register the domain name. It involves their registrar. It involves the registry operator, and it involves the clearinghouse. So there are a few, a number of of possible permutations of this process and how the information could flow, how the communications occur between all of these parties. So that's what we're going to look at next. There's been a group of registries and some others, I think, that did some initial thinking on this and constructed a model. And I'm going to ask Jeff if you'd like to go through that briefly.
Okay, I won't go through each of the steps. I'll just say that the premise behind this model was, at the last minute, I guess it was decided that both that a trademark claims process and a sunrise process had to be offered, which is fine. The harder part was the prospect of having to do it the first 60 days of, quote, general registration. And that was all the guidance that was given. So what does general registration mean? Well, for different registries, that could mean a whole bunch of different things. That could mean a first-come, first-serve. That could mean a founders program. That could mean an auction. That could mean probably 30 different things that I can't even think of right now. And so to come up with a model that was that flexible to handle all of those situations, but also the premise of the fact that there may be hundreds of these all going live around the same time, they're all with the first 60 days, some are overlapping. The fact that even just from our experience of launching .co, as being the back-end operator, in the first 15 minutes we got 100,000 registrations, but that's not even all the hard part. We got 19 million create commands from registrars and 5 million checks, all within 15 minutes. So the discussion that we had with the registrars, with some registrars and some registries, was that we didn't think that relying completely in real time on a clearinghouse to do everything was necessarily the best way to go for all situations, and that we adopted kind of a model that at least Neustar has in when we operate the North American numbering plan, which basically helps route all the phone calls in North America. So we maintain all the databases and all the updates, but rather than actually having every call come through our database, which would be a lot, we push out updates every 15 minutes to all the switches of the carriers, and so that it's the carriers that actually maintain those databases, so they actually route the calls. Kind of a similar model here, where the clearinghouse would be collecting all the information, but would be disseminating that information to the registries so that the registries could then host the claim notices to display out to the registrants, but also be able to, instead of the registry having to query the clearinghouse with those, you know, just one registry, 19 million creates in the first 15 minutes, which obviously would be a hardship if every registry is using the clearinghouse at the same time. Rather than doing that, it's the registry could query itself for the information and then spit back the notices. And it's not just taking notices, it's also getting input on whether they want to proceed with that registration or alternatively cancel that registration. So this model, again, without going through it, just kind of walks through how all of that would work in our minds. Obviously, it's just a first cut, but there was a lot of thinking that went around this, and I'll just leave it at that.
Does anyone want to comment on the Jeff proposal? Okay, Christina, and then Mary.
Jeff and I have had this conversation, but I think a lot of trademark owners are going to be very nervous about having a registry have access to all of their trademark data. And it seems to me that assuming that we go with this model, the only way you're going to be able to eliminate those fears is to put very significant restrictions on the scope of what the registry can do with it. And in order to do that, you're going to have language in the registry agreement, which, as I understand it, is done. So I'm not quite sure how we move forward with this.
I think I had Mary next, right?
Respond.
So I had a specific question for Jeff, and then I had a comment about the trademark claims form. Should I bring both up right now? Okay. So I'll first ask my question to Jeff, and on behalf of the group that prepared the straw man proposal. It's a really specific question, and I think I'm just asking for some clarity on what you've called step two in the process, where the clearinghouse is supposed to provide, I think, a list of eligible registrable strings. And I'm just wondering if you could give some clarity as to what that really means.
Okay, I'll answer Mary's question first. I guess the list of eligible strings are the strings minus the, quote, I'll call them, quote, illegal characters. So minus the ampersands, minus the some of the other marks that aren't recognizable in a domain name string. So the clearinghouse would collect the trademark, but then at some point it needs to convert it to the identical string. So that's what that meant. It wasn't any kind of review. It was really that simple. And then on Christina's question, she's right. We did have this conversation, and those conversations happened, interestingly enough, in 1996 with the North American Numbering Plan, when we were selected as the provider of that as well. And so, you know, I hear what you're saying. Those arguments were made back then. And I think with restrictions, as you said, I think it could be enforced. I will add, though, that the way to fix it is not by the registry agreement, but it's by making the registry sign an agreement with the clearinghouse provider, that agreement has not yet been set. So without reopening up the guidebook or reopening the registry agreement, we could perhaps work it that way.
Okay, and I think Mary had another question. Is that right? And then we'll go back to you, and then you and Christina. Okay, I'm losing track of the queue here. We'll keep going.
I can hold my comment. It's not about the proposal. Okay. It's about the form.
Okay, so now we're back to Jeff, unless you finished your comments, and if not, Joe. Okay.
Yeah, so one, I wanted to just say that the diagram that Jeff and whoever else worked on it with him, I'm not sure, but as I reviewed this, I thought it was a very good description of a way that this works, but I think you can't read too much into it and expect that it's the only way that it would work. As Jeff mentioned, doing a large volume of transactions during a land rush, we see this pretty regularly as well. Many times we have registrars that don't do checks before they do an ad. They'll do the ad first. So that really changes the dynamic of the process. So I think what's most important in this is really identifying the responsibilities and roles of what has to happen, who has to do that, and where it fits into the workflow. But there isn't going to be one standard way that you can expect that that all registrars will work with registries, or again, to echo Jeff's comment, you know, it's not going to be a standard way of the way that the domain name registries work with the trademark clearinghouse. In some cases, it will make sense to do a real-time transaction, and in other cases, it makes more sense to do a bulk, and that should be left up to the registry to decide.
Okay, I think I had Matt, and then I'm over here with Russ, and I lost track.
I just wanted to pick up on what Christina said, and I don't see why this would be any different than previous TLD launches where the trademark information was passed directly to the registry. So I don't think that's a huge change.
Russ, do you want to comment? And then I guess, Christina, if you want to comment back.
Well, I think that the response to that, it is different because it's going to be all of your marks being put in simultaneously and it's a significant amount of data. And the question I would have back to Jeff is, if, in fact, the registry did an agreement with the clearinghouse, would ICANN still have compliance oversight over the clearinghouse in that scenario? And that's the debate on the registry. I'm sorry. So in that scenario, then, if the clearinghouse is going to do something violative with the data, how would you go about getting recourse if there wasn't that compliance oversight?
Christina, did you have a follow-up? I don't know.
Well, no. I mean, you know, Russ answered, you know, gave the response I would have given to Matt. I just think it's really important for people to understand that from a trademark owner perspective, if this is all going to reside at the registry level and there's no contractual nexus between ICANN and the registry relating to registry use of this data, I'm going to tell my clients not to do it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so good question. I think that's handled, at least in our situation with the North American Numbering Plan, again, just as an example, it's handled with third-party beneficiary rules. So you could grant ICANN third-party beneficiary rights, and I'm just abbreviating it. It's actually pages of our agreement with the industry in that instance. So there's a lot of parallels. I'd be happy to walk through it. But I think your issues are very legitimate, but I think they're solvable.
Okay. Jonathan?
Yeah, I want to come in back to the previous point about real time. So I'm not sure if we're done on the data or if anyone wants to respond to that, because I wanted to pick up on this issue of, what, as I understand it, what is proposed and envisaged is that we are taking a pretty significant step forward here from what's been done in the past in terms of the real-time availability query followed by what would normally be a domain create command. And we're proposing to insert something in a well-established and universal process. And so and I just wasn't 100% sure that, I think, Joe, did you mention that in all cases it may not be real-time? I just want to make sure we're all clear that that is what is envisaged, as I've just described it. We're putting in a unique and a new step, if you like, into the process, and that has particular demands. It may not be that, as Joe said, Jeff's is the only... Jeff's model is the only way of dealing with that. There may be others, but as long as we're all clear on what we're trying to deal with.
I think Joe wanted to respond.
Yeah, so, we have a pretty high-performing system that does a lot of transactions within the .com registry, but we still have registrars that do local checks just for their own performance. If you're trying to do high-volume activity and your customers are waiting for your responses, in some cases, it makes more sense that you allow the registry to do a batch process, that I have that file locally, or you provide one of your services that is in my data center, because the location of where the registry is and the location of where the trademark clearinghouse provider, I could be talking about tens or hundreds of milliseconds of latency, and that's not going to be acceptable if I'm trying to maintain the performance and meet my SLAs.
So just to be crystal clear here I think we're talking about doing perhaps an availability check against a copy of the zone data, for example. Yeah. So, it's there are some subtle technical points here that need to be fleshed out.
Excellent. And I think I've got Chuck now who wanted to make a comment, and then I forgot who else was doing. Okay. We'll go to Jeff after Chuck.
Okay. Is this on? I guess it's on.
Can we have this on, please?
Testing. There we go. Thank you. Christina made the statement that the applicant guidebook registry agreement is done. And so my question is really directed at staff. I think it's mostly done. I think it's mostly done. But I believe, and this is why I'm directing it at staff, none of us want a lot of changes from here on forward. But if that's the snag in terms of making this thing work right, my question to staff is, I believe there's probably a mechanism for making that happen. Is that correct, or am I speaking out of hand there?
I think Kurt will answer that.
Chuck, so was your question really about a mechanism for making a change in the guidebook, or was it specific to this technical question?
Well, it was specific to the agreement that's in the guidebook.
Right.
So, because the assumption in a lot of this discussion is that you can't change the agreement from this point forward, and I'm sure we don't want to do much there.
Right.
But if that was a real critical issue, is there a mechanism for doing that?
Well, yeah, the really short answer is yes. After this, we'll publish a version of the guidebook that will be under rev control. So it'll be rev 1.0. Simple changes, there'll be a mechanism where staff might be able to make simple changes. More complex changes would have to go through public comment and board review. And also, with respect to the clearinghouse, the guidebook establishes a broad set of rules, and then a provider has detailed sets of rules, just like the dispute resolution providers. They provided detailed rules that fit within the broader guidelines. Anyway, I hope that was helpful.
I think we'll go over here because you've been in line.
Thank you.
Please state your name.
Chris from Oz Registry. I have a number of comments that I could make about Jeff's proposal, but just putting those aside for the moment, I think it's important to understand that there are two distinct things going on here. One only involves a subset of the data that's maintained within the clearinghouse. So one is a registrar is trying to establish whether a name that is attempting to be registered is going to hit a record in the clearinghouse. Now, all of the information contained in the clearinghouse is not required for that check to be done. All that's required is the list of the names that are in the clearinghouse, and that check can be completed. The second part of the process is then, if you hit one of those names that are in the clearinghouse, you then need to display a notice to that potential registrant, that does contain all of the information that is within the clearinghouse. Now, if you separate those two processes, I don't think many people would have a problem with the first one being done with local copies of data kept by registrars or kept by registries or so forth. That's just a big list of names. So there shouldn't be too many issues with that. We don't even know who owns the names at that point. And in fact, one entry on that list could actually correspond to hundreds of registrations in the actual clearinghouse. So nobody should have too much of a problem with that. Now, the reason that in Jeff's proposal that he's trying to get the rest of the data into his registry is because he doesn't want to be relying on a third party. He doesn't want to rely on the clearinghouse being up and available and working to have people register names in his TLD. Now, if the trademark owners are prepared to accept the concession on the notice that's being displayed, then we can eliminate that as well. And then registries don't need to get an entire copy of all of the trademark base. Essentially, the concession would just need to be, if the trademark clearinghouse is down, registrations can go ahead with just a generic notice that says, hey, Mr. Registrant, the name you're trying to register is in the clearinghouse, but at the moment we're unable to get the details of the exact information in the clearinghouse, and here's a URL that you can go to later to get that information, Registrant, do you still want to proceed? And this is only in the unlikely case that the clearinghouse is down. So registries get what they want. They can still go ahead and do the registrations while the clearinghouse is down. But you guys get what you want in terms of all that data that's contained within the clearinghouse isn't out there in the wild with all the registries and the registrars. So if mark holders would concede that that would be an acceptable approach, and if we put SLAs in the clearinghouse contract, I don't know, 99.9% of the time, we're effectively only talking about 4 hours a month where it's possible that this modified notice would be displayed. It probably doesn't seem like a big deal.
Okay. Thank you. I think we'll respond to your comment. We'll have Jeff do that, and then we're going to come back to Zaid, who's been in the queue.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's exactly why, you know, and you all helped with that, too. So there were a bunch of people that were on in developing that model. That's exactly right. And I don't think it's three nines. I think it's at least what we have to do, five nines, right, at the very least, which is only 8 minutes or something like that a month. So I think that's the excellent question. I think you posed it really well to the trademark owners that's what they're going to have to put up with, because we as registries can't just stop registrations. That would just not be acceptable. So that's a good question. And to address the other on a final point, this is just one model, and I don't necessarily say this is the right model that we proposed, but I do want to just emphasize that while having flexibility is good for different models, I would stress that the registrars we talked to did not want to have 500 different models for 500 different registries. So you got to kind of balance that.
Jonathan?
Thanks, Margie. It's just a response. I mean, I think that's a really interesting and innovative suggestion, and it corresponds quite closely with a system I built at NetNames a few years ago, where we had the online registration system, and people could query a for a match, and there was a kind of traffic light system at that point that said, red, you know, proceed at your peril, you've got an exact match in a trademark database. Amber, do you want to, and so I think a variant at or around that suggestion makes a lot of sense, where there's essentially a traffic light system related to correspondence in trademark databases. And as you say, as a previous speaker said, it doesn't necessarily have to then throw back all the data, depending on the status.
I have Jay Scott, and then I have Bart. Were you in the queue? And then I think we need to go back to Zaid.
Okay,
Marion,
clarification. What's in the notice is not a trademark owner's issue, except to tell them that there is something in the clearinghouse and do you want to proceed? That's all trademark owners care about, and then that we get a notice back should they proceed to let us know that there's something. So all this other information were concessions that were required by other people than trademark owners. Okay, so that's not our issue. Next, I just want to say with all this, the back-end stuff, trademark owners are not going to be caring about if there's different models as long as the front end works the way it does. You put it in, they register, you get a notice. That's all they really care about. But the one thing I did hear earlier when we talked about innovation and things is, you know, different entry points for information that would come in and might be regional. And that and some of the data points might be slightly different because of regional differences in the systems. Fine. The biggest thing is, though, whatever you do within some region has to be standardized. There can't be four different types within one region and four different types within another region. Everybody needs to decide on what's going to go in the Latin American region, and those are consistent across whoever takes it in. Because where it gets complicated and the efficiencies fall out is when there are five different data points. There are two here, three here, all five over here, and that gets confusing for the people trying to make sure they're getting the data into the system correctly.
Got it. Okay. Bart, Mary, Zaid. That's the cue.
Yeah, we're actually looking at various options, so I think that the model that was introduced by Jeff is a sensible one. One of the things that we're looking into to have the registrar doing an EPP domain check command on the clearinghouse as an option. So at that point in time, you bypass one party. Could be a more efficient way of looking at it.
Okay. Mary?
I'm actually making a similar point to Jay Scott, but to follow up on it, because he's absolutely right. I mean, there are a number of concerns over the notice, and before we run away with this idea of the generic notice, which conceptually might be a great idea, and it's certainly for expediency and getting things going, that's good, but we do need to think about whoever it is, whether in the RFP or the operator, what's in that notice, because you don't want something to just say, you've bumped into a trademark, would you like to proceed? From the potential registrant perspective, there's at least two concerns. One would be the possibility of being intimidated, but the other would be the possibility of the dreaded G word or some other kind of incentivization to proceed without due inquiry, and I would caution against that.
Zaid?
Zaid Jamil, just a short question. And at the, I like the slide, and I just wanted to ask at the point, you know, the risk of asking something maybe obvious, and starting with Bart and then and other people on the panel, what is the problem that you foresee having this process become perpetual post-launch as well, perpetually?
Jeff, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I just don't, we shouldn't really, this is really an operational issue. I don't think we should talk about the policy. I think that's done. That's decided. Let's save that for other arena.
We can start with Bart.
What's that?
My question was first directed with Bart.
But, okay. Opine on policy.
What would be the problem of having this happen post-launch perpetually? Could this be done continuously even after launch? Would that be a problem? That's my question. And maybe for Bart.
Right. This is a... We were under strict instructions that this we wouldn't get involved in the policy.
We're trying to do implementation, not policy at this point. I apologize for that. One more comment.
Yes, the question is whether the list of domain names has to be just something that the registrar can find, or is actually the fact that the domain that, or a string is in the clearinghouse of public record where that. The public should be able to look it up before registration is made. So I understand that there is a question about confidentiality of a trademark being there, but I'm quite frankly, if you want to have a right and then again keep that confidential, this is kind of a contradiction. So why wouldn't the public be able to query this trademark clearinghouse? And we've got a very good protocol. It's called the DNS protocol. It's extremely efficient, and I think most of us here, precisely because of that protocol, it could be used for it.
I think Jonathan was first, and then
Christina.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I think this point has come up before, and obviously I can't speak for all trademark owners and don't, but I think the general view is that individual queries by the public of the clearinghouse for a particular name is one thing and is likely to not be a concern. But I think what folks are really concerned about would be the ability to do a search for all of the deposits made by a particular brand owner. That is where I think people are going to have some real issues, just simply because you're essentially talking about, in many cases, here's their most valuable portfolio of assets. Here's all the information you need.
Okay. Jonathan, did you want to comment?
I think Christina's answered it in the way that I guess I'm trying to think about whether there is a way of doing some form of exact match check without revealing. So it comes down to a kind of who is stroke availability check within the trademark database, and the opportunity there is to do an exact match check without any further data coming back. But I mean, mining the database is clearly going to be an issue, so that needs thinking about.
Yeah, I was just, this chart does not address the issue of whether the clearinghouse is publicly accessible or query. I just find Christina's argument about it sounds like the who is argument, I think, but that's not meant to be addressed by this. This is merely the interaction between the clearinghouse, the registry, the registrar, the trademark owner, and the registrant. I think I got all five. To answer Mary's question about the notice. The notice is actually in the guidebook. It was drafted by the STI group, and I don't know if it was modified much, but that's been in the guidebook. So we're not saying that the notice should be changed from that. In fact, it has to be in multiple languages. I think in all of the ICANN, or the whatever languages ICANN supports, like five or six or whatever the number is. So that's another complication in there.
I'm going to go back to Karen because I know we have to go on to additional topics.
Okay. I think Mary wanted to respond to the last one. Go ahead.
Actually, it was about the form, but not on that last point, because I think we are talking about two forms, the new idea of the generic form and then the form in the guidebook. If I can make a quick comment or question about the form in the guidebook, and you know, it does cover a lot of ground, and it was the result of community negotiation and compromise and consensus. I think my specific question now that we're in operations mode is with respect to the notification of the class of goods and services. And when the final form comes up, I hope it isn't just you bumped into a trademark in class 2 or, you know, class 11 or whatever it is, because there are things in there that registrants will need to know what exactly is a hand tool, for example. So if some kind of link could be provided to the list at the very least for information instead of just the class or even just the class plus fabrics, that would be very helpful to applicants, I think.
All right.
Real quick. Just to respond, that's in our proposal. It's all the information that's put into the clearinghouse would be displayed back to the prospective registrant. So it's not just a general, it's class 42 and then no description. Everything that's provided for the clearinghouse would be spit back in multiple languages and all that good stuff.
Okay, we're back to Karen now.
Okay, thank you. The next slide that I wanted to show was another depiction of the process. And this is something that staff had come up with initially. This is our first attempt at how to scope out this process, this trademark claims process, and integrate it into the existing registration process and how all the parties would work. And I put it up mostly to show, although there are some differences with the graphic that Jeff described, it's actually similar in a number of respects. One of the principles we settled on was that the parties should interact with with one party, and the party that is providing a communication should be someone they're familiar with and understand, have some sort of working relationship with. So, you know, in that respect, the registrant is getting and receiving the notices and communications from the registrar, not from the trademark clearinghouse, which is an unknown entity to them. Similarly, the trademark holder is getting the notice at the end from the trademark clearinghouse rather than some registry or registry operator. So that I thought was a positive development that we had kind of come up with similar processes in that regard. So there's been a lot of helpful discussion on the clearinghouse. I've taken a lot of things that need to be clarified, a lot of work on the back end in terms of coordinating between the registries and registrars. Any other comments anyone wants to make on the claims process before we move on?
Go ahead. State your name, please.
Sorry, Chris from Oz Registry. So similar thing, it's on both this picture and Jeff's picture. I would just raise some questions. Is it necessary for a registrar to use the registry, effectively being the registry acting as a proxy to the clearinghouse? There was mentioned before about registrars worrying about having different implementations from all the different registries, etc. Surely it'd be better for a registrar to implement once to the clearinghouse and be done with it regardless.
And there's also questions about, given that I'm just realistically doing an exact match string to a list of strings in a database, perhaps if I'm a registrar, what I might do is implement, for example, VeriSign service and use that one to check all the domain names and all the other TLDs just by changing the TLD on the end and send all my claims queries through to them and so forth. So there are lots of potential issues with that, and I'm not really sure it's required. Also, I'm not really sure it's required for the registry to proxy back the trademark information from the clearinghouse back to the registrar. They're effectively just taking something from the registrar, sending it off to the clearinghouse, getting the response. They're just being a proxy. It doesn't really make much sense. Surely the registrars would rather just go directly to the clearinghouse and get the information rather than have to deal with all the different implementations that the registries come up with. Then finally, just before when we were talking about the notice and so forth, all the information that you guys want on the notice isn't necessarily able to be displayed. And the current version of the guidebook sort of shows dot, dot, dot to show that the information is too big and it can't be displayed and it's allowed to be truncated. It mentions that it's allowed to be truncated. So you're actually expecting the potential registrant to go somewhere else to get the information anyway. And presumably that's the purpose of the public access to the clearinghouse, so that the registrant knows that, and there's supposed to be a URL in the notice for the registrant to click on and get more information anyway. So if the notice just contains that URL and the registrant then clicks on that URL and that trademark clearinghouse site happens to be down, well, then the registrant's going to have to go back there later and deal with it. But that's sort of, back to the issue about registries proxying all the information.
Jeff, you want to respond?
Yeah, on that one, just a question. I guess in your – we had discussed that actually in a group, and I think the registries didn't want to necessarily rely on just an assertion by a registrar that it actually did everything, that because it's the registry's TLD, the registry wanted to make sure that it knew and it would actually be in the middle of the process. Because under your process, it sounds like the registrar would do all the checking, the registrar would send out the notice, but there'd be no way for the registry to actually know that that was done. We didn't know using that kind of model, and nor did the registries really want to necessarily rely on that.
You could do that contractually in your registrar agreement, forcing the registrar to have done that stuff.
Sure, other than a contract.
And they can
right.
send a notification in the create command that says, yes, I've done everything I'm supposed to do. So then you're legally covered. They're telling you that they've done everything.
The registries in that group weren't comfortable just relying on an assertion. But that's why. But I understand your point. Yeah.
Sure, it's the same. It's the same thing, kind of that Jeff is saying. But I want to take it a step further. The way things are structured right now, the registry has the contractual obligation, and so I'm not sure our legal staff is gonna be comfortable with that kind of process. Not that we don't trust our customers, the registrars, but there's an important obligation we have with regard to that, and so that needs to be kept in mind when we look at that process.
And I'm going back to Karen now.
Okay, thank you. Just to quickly finish up briefly, we did want to touch on the Sunrise registration process and how the clearinghouse would be involved in that. The kind of basic questions are up here on the slide. How will the clearinghouse be involved in the Sunrise? How would they interact with the registries, registrars? And how would they be involved in the dispute resolution aspect of the Sunrise process. So there is a requirement for a Sunrise period when a new TLD starts up that needs to be at least 30 days. There are some eligibility requirements. A trademark should be nationally or regionally registered, validated with proof of use, or court validated, or specifically protected by a statute or treaty. And the registry has the discretion to create its own Sunrise requirements. And then another new aspect to this is that where there is a registration in a Sunrise period that matches an entry in the clearinghouse, that a notice would be provided to the trademark holder. This is a kind of a rough attempt to sketch this out. It's way oversimplified to be able to fit on a slide. One point to make clear about this is it depicts a scenario where the person or the entity registering the domain name, the Sunrise Registrant, which is the top row there, is not the same as the trademark holder that is getting a particular notice. So there may be some overlap there. You know, in many cases, they would be the same. But you've got the Sunrise registration taking place, determination of whether it meets the eligibility requirements, and then when the registration proceeds, there is that notice that is generated to the trademark holder that is registered in the clearinghouse. So any comments or feedback on this?
Okay, Jonathan?
Yeah, mine's just a very simple comment on the flow chart here. I'm certain, or almost certain, that your diamond down the bottom on eligibility requirements refers only to trademark eligibility requirements, but bearing in mind many TLDs might be introduced with a range of other sponsorship or other eligibility requirements, it's worth just making that crystal clear that here we're only referring to those pertaining to the trademark clearinghouse.
Thank you. Any other comments? Bart?
I think one of the things you should look into is if you do the check, so from the registry to the trademark clearinghouse, so basically you're checking the Sunrise registrant information with what is in the clearinghouse. So there must be an exact match between all those data points that you're asking for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there may be a risk in doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point, because oftentimes the domain name registrant does not match exactly the trademark holder.
Just maybe briefly explaining, and it's of course difficult without having a real chart in front of us. The way how we currently implement it is that a brand owner comes to the clearinghouse. All the various checks that need to be done are done, so trademark validity and so on are checked. Also, eligibility requirements are checked. And when, for each of the TLDs that are supported by the clearinghouse that we've developed, when those requirements are all met, the registrar that will sponsor the registration or will submit the registration to the registry will get an auth code. And that auth code is then being submitted in the create command to the registry. The registry checks whether this particular domain name submitted by this particular registrar has this particular auth code, that in order to avoid gaming. So that's the way how we do it. It's slightly less complicated than this and prevents gaming, in my opinion.
Jonathan?
I guess just in aligned with what Bart is saying, it's really one's got to envisage it in two separate packages. The one is the authenticity or accuracy of the trademark data, and the second is the correspondence between the domain name application or the Sunrise application and that trademark data. And they're two separate processes in many ways.
Anyone else want to comment? Anyone from the floor? Oh, Christina?
I have a question. I was just wondering how in this process you've built in the Sunrise eligibility challenge process.
It's actually the next slide, but
do we want to move on to that now,
okay.
Or anyone else has comments on this? I think we'll move on.
Okay. So based on the clearinghouse documentation, there are these four grounds on which a Sunrise registration may be challenged. One, the registrant does not hold an eligible trademark registration. Two, the domain name is not identical to the trademark on which they based their Sunrise registration. Three, the registration is not meeting the requirements, i.e., of national, regional effect, court validated, or protected by a treaty or statute. Or four, it doesn't meet the date requirements. It either was not issued before the registry agreement was executed, or not applied for beyond before the date on which ICANN posted applications. So this is a new, this is another aspect to the clearinghouse, which we'll open it up for comments on.
Werner?
I just have a question. I don't understand what you mean by registrant here. Registrant of what? Of the domain name or of the trademark clearinghouse date entry?
On number one.
Yes.
Yes, the entity making the Sunrise registration. So that is the registrant.
The applicant for a given domain name in a given TLD.
Right.
And on three is the TM registration. So these are two different cases of where something may be wrong. One, they're not going in the same direction, are they? Do they? In one, you have somebody who says, look, you cannot have this domain name because you're not eligible. In the other one, the potential domain applicant says, look, I mean, this trademark registration is not acceptable. They're opposite, right. Or did I misunderstand?
If I understand your question, I think there's some overlap or between one and three. I envision, you know, the registrant doesn't have any documentation or, you know, it turned out that they didn't have an actual authenticated trademark. Or three, they submitted some documentation, but it was not, you know, found to be what was required.
Okay, but it does not. This here does not contemplate a case where actually whatever is in the Sunrise, in the trademark clearinghouse turns out to be not applicable to this specific case of a TLD.
Well, this is about an actual Sunrise registration, so challenging a registration that has been made. I think you're asking about, you know, whether an entry in the clearinghouse itself, right, you know, can be challenged
at this point, because this is where things will be visible. The people say, well, what do you mean you have a right here? No, I mean, this is impossible. Mm-hmm. So then it should be possible to challenge.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll go to Bart, and then we'll go to your question.
Maybe a question to ICANN staff. to which extent will you allow registries to determine itself what is an eligible trademark registration? I'm giving an example. If .Berlin comes across and they say, well, in order to play in Sunrise, you need to have a trademark that's valid in Germany and in the U.S. because we have various Berlins in the U.S. To have those nexus requirements, is that something that the registry itself can impose, or will it be required for every registry to accept every single trademark that is in the clearinghouse in order to form a basis of a Sunrise?
Amy, do you want to respond, or Dan?
Thanks, Bart. This is Dan Halloran from ICANN staff. I think the rules say that any trademark has to be eligible to participate, so they couldn't discriminate based on the trademark, but they could still impose restrictions on who can register in the TLDs, which would kind of overlap that. Go ahead.
So,
Jeff.
I mean, it was our understanding basically that it was just we'd only have to accept Sunrise registrations for those registrations that would otherwise be eligible in that TLD. So if you're only accepting, if your TLD is limited to German registrants, then there'd be no reason why your Sunrise would have to go beyond that.
We'll go here, and then I think we're wrapping it up because we're running out of time.
So concluding, that would mean that the registrant is not necessarily then the trademark owner. Yeah? Yeah, for instance, if you are a U.S. company and you have a U.S. trademark and you want to register a .Berlin, but .Berlin says, well, you need to be a resident in Berlin, then you need to give the right to somebody else.
I don't think you necessarily need to give the right to someone else. Whoever applies for a domain name has to meet all of the qualifications within that registry. So if it's a unrestricted registry, restricted, whatever the conditions are within the charter of that registry defines the registration requirements, and the trademark check is one part of that.
Over here, please.
I mean, we've never had a problem, and to my knowledge, in a restricted small pool TLD that you had to meet eligibility requirements to get in. We had people faking who they were to get in to say, I'm a museum, when you're not a museum, but I own a trademark for MoMA. And so I get in because I licensed it from the Museum of Modern Art in New York. To my knowledge, I mean, the registrant has to qualify to get into the registry based on being eligible. Then, if you pass that threshold test, and they're running a Sunrise, which they have to do, and you have a trademark registration for the string you want, you get that, unless they can challenge you based on one of these. And I think most small restricted TLDs or restricted TLDs also have a charter dispute resolution policy that allows you to challenge him by saying, wait, they're not a museum.
Tom?
Hi, Tom from Usurca. I wonder if there's a clause missing here to challenge a Sunrise, which is challenging its use, whether it's actually been in use or not. The word use doesn't appear here.
Werner?
I'm still unsure about this, the question of whether, you know, the presence in the trademark clearinghouse would be sufficient to reject any applicant. Suppose there is a trademark for something like Champs-Élysées, you know, wonderful name, and there isn't actually an application based on other rights, not trademark rights, for a domain that would be Champs-Élysées.Paris, specifically in Paris where the place is. Now, on what grounds could any trademark anywhere in the world say, look, we're stronger than whoever is the legitimate representative of something that is a local resource and has been appointed by the city or whichever way this has happened. So I don't think that the trademark can be considered to be, in all cases, a superior right, especially as, if we look at city names, it is even by law not allowed to make them trademarks. So there is many trademarks, actually, that are morally less strong than a collective right to that name by many, many people.
Would anyone like to reply to that? Okay. Isn't that the eligibility requirements, though? Isn't that the separate from the trademark? It was, in other words, in the situation you're talking about, you've got the trademark rights, but you also have the additional eligibility requirements that the registry might have.
Well, taking this example, it could be a U.S. Trademark, Champs-Élysées, and they have to question whether the city of Paris can put its monuments and place names into domain names. And what right would some trademark somewhere else in the world stop this from happening?
Right, and I think that's where the registry would decide, in their eligibility requirements, whether they have some policy that would deal with that.
So the registry could say trademarks that are not of a certain realm would not count.
Is that?
So the registry or the TLD could say that only trademarks of a certain realm would count in terms of the clearinghouse.
This is Dan Halloran from ICANN staff again. I think what we were trying to say is only registrants from a certain realm can apply. They can't discriminate based on the trademark, but they can discriminate based on the registrant.
Yeah, but in the specific case, it's the opposite problem. We've got a trademark that has absolutely nothing to do with the place. You know, they chose it's outside, and they were concerned possibly about this being used somewhere in a TLD about where they are. But here, we are in the place, that actually where there are collective rights to that name, and where is the original place? And, why would somebody from the outside be able to say, look, this domain name cannot exist?
So to be eligible for a Sunrise registration in a restricted TLD, you'd have to both meet the Sunrise trademark requirements and the registration requirements for that TLD.
Yes, but the problem is that we don't have a mechanism to at least challenge, in that specific context, the clearinghouse registration. That is missing. I mean, we cannot have a situation where any registration of a trademark anywhere in the world is going to stop things happening somewhere else that have nothing to do with it.
I think we're misunderstanding something. Maybe we can check it offline. Yeah. Okay.
What I think he's coming down to is to say that if there are terms that are words in the dictionary that have meaning outside the trademark and somebody owns it, so and that somebody can say we have rights other than trademark rights in this term too, but they can't get a Sunrise registration. Okay, I can't get it because I'm Champs-Élysées, and what I am is I'm the shop owners of the Champs-Élysées. and I can't get a Sunrise registration because I don't have a registration, but there's a U.S. trademark owner that's trying to get it, and he's saying there's no way for the Champs-Élysées shop owners without a registration to say, we have rights too, and you shouldn't give them that premium.
So I think another thing that's missing here is registries could have other registration policies like Sunrises for things other than just trademarks, this kind of trademark. They could have other Sunrises or other, like, Jeff.
And I think that's been done before. Right. That's not a concept that's new. I think Asia did something similar to that. And so you just have to look at other models that have been done before to deal with these situations, but they're out there.
I'm going to now hand it over.
Be handled outside of the trade of the Sunrise mechanism, possibly before. Yeah.
Okay. I think all he's saying is that if you look at specific Sunrise processes run by different operators, they are able to put in other requirements, processes, different sub-phases, and there has been experience in the past, say, as in .Asia, where that's happened. So that kind of thing might be a useful model for whoever the operator is in this case.
Thank you. I'm going to hand it now to Kurt.
It just needs to be remembered that this is a minimum floor. This is only a minimum floor that the registry has to do. They can do more if they so choose to do more, and if it fits a business model. So there is innovation that can be built on top of this. This is not all you can do. It's the least you have to do.
So first, thank you for the fantastic amount of information that was provided just during this really short period of time by the panel and by those who participated in the audience. I'd offer you a consulting fee, but evidently we have this anti-revolving door thing now. So, but I can offer you the continued opportunity to work on this problem with us. This session indicated, you know, I think there's, you know, X more amount of hours to work to flesh out details and get an understanding so that we, when this implementation is done, it meets our original goals and does so in a way that works good, stacks neatly, and is available for a reasonable price. So thank you very much, everybody. Thanks for attending the session. I thought it was great. Thank you, Karen and Margie, for all your work on it.